Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode in Season 2 of the CarverCast podcast. This podcast is an initiative of the Carver Project and is co-hosted by myself, Penina Achayo-Laker, and my friend and colleague, John Inazu. John and I are both faculty at Washington University in St. Louis and fellows with the Carver Project. Our hope with this podcast is to engage with Christian faculty in higher education through highlighting their scholarship, research, teaching, and service to bridge those connections between university, church, and society. Today, we're really excited to kick off this conversation with a dear friend of ours, a colleague, and a fellow, Carver fellow, Joshua Swamidas. Joshua, welcome to the CarverCast podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me here. It's great to hang out and talk with you too.
Yeah, Josh, great to have you. We want to jump right in and we want to start by telling you, so many of our past guests have been easy to situate. We can talk about John Hendricks, who's an illustrator, full stop, and people get that. It's going to be a little more complicated to explain sort of what you do because you play a lot of roles in an interdisciplinary context. You're both a doctor and a researcher. So why don't we start with just a little bit about your how you situate yourself in the academic universe, what your focus is, and what the orbit of your daily life is in the university.
Yeah, so I'm a physician and a scientist. I'm in the laboratory and genomic medicine division at WashU as a professor there. And I, in my scientific work, I run an NIH-funded lab where we try and use artificial intelligence to solve problems at the intersection of chemistry, biology, and medicine. And one of the main ways we've done that is by looking at building software algorithms that can help suss out how it is and why it is that certain drugs become toxic. That's been where most of my work has been. And my PhD is in computer science, though I have a medical degree. So it ended up being a really great pairing where I'm able to develop new computer algorithms, often using deep learning, which is another type of artificial intelligence algorithm out there.
Yeah, that's great. So tell me, what's an example of a drug that becomes toxic what are the practical implications of identifying that? Does it take it off the market or what happens then?
Well, so there are a lot of drugs that become toxic, right? And the type that we're interested in are one of the hardest types of toxicities to predict where it's idiosyncratic, which means that the vast majority of people, it's entirely okay. But then in a small handful of people, it ends up causing really severe toxicity. And that's a really big deal when that happens. So if that happens, that means that you didn't really pick it up during the clinical studies. The drug is on the market, being given to a lot of people, and then people still might actually be having very secure reactions and even dying. One of the molecules that we've studied a lot is terbinafine. Terbinafine is Lamisil. It's what often people are putting, kind of just rubbing on their skin, which is one way to take it. But it's an antifungal. We don't really have very many very many good oral antifungals. And people started to think that maybe we could actually put terbinafine and, take that orally to cure fungal infections. And when that happened, we discovered by actually seeing some patients die that occasionally it's really, really toxic. And it's been a real puzzle to figure out, for example, how that drug became toxic. And the algorithms that we make are really designed to make that process easier to figure out what is it that's making this drug toxic so that we can maybe fix it or how to better manage it or maybe even make new drugs that don't have that same liability.
So this is fascinating. And we've had so many conversations over the years and this has never struck me before, but it would seem to me that a big piece of this or an implication of this would possibly be sort of a negligence standard, even a liability possibility in the research trial phase of some of these drugs. So if somebody forgot in a big way, so do you ever end up testifying or doing that sort of work in this area?
Well, no. I think what's challenging about it is it's not like there's a certain set of things that if we all did, we'd be able to know and pick up every toxic drug. I think it all ends up being a lot more in the gray space, right? Yeah. Where you have, and I think what's particularly difficult is for rare side effects that are severe, those types, it's not easy to imagine how to do real good diligence there. In the end, no one wants to put out a drug that's even going to hurt a rare number of patients. Mm-hmm. But there's no established way that we can actually solve that problem by doing everything, because ultimately these things just end up surprising us over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm actually curious too, because it seems like with the algorithm, it seems like you're building in your lab to try and detect some of these indicators early. It seems like in a perfect scenario, for every drug that gets out in the market, you know, you'd be able to catch its ability to be toxic early. But how do you decide and determine which sort of drugs to start to look into, besides them reporting people that are reacting differently? So do you try and just look at a specific kind of drug, regardless of if people are reporting anything about its side effects, or do you have a core group of drugs that you focus on?
Well, one way to think about it is our group has really built a really cool hammer or screwdriver, however you want to look at it, right? That can do a lot of things. And so what you just listed off was a whole bunch of different types of nails or screws that it could start working on, right? But there isn't one way to do it. So we could look at a drug, for example, that's toxic and we don't know why. That's a common thing that we do. It's already on the market. We know it gets toxic in particular context, but we don't know why. And we go and try and solve that mystery. That's one thing that we can do, right? Another thing we can do too is work with drug companies to look at the drugs that they're considering putting on the market, considering putting on patients, to figure out what are the potential risks associated with that they maybe haven't picked up yet, and see how they could actually rule it out those risks by doing some more experiments, or maybe decide maybe that's a molecule that just isn't worth pursuing. We should go with these other ones that we don't see those liabilities with. And those are just a couple ways, but there's a lot more different ways you can use that tool. Because what we've really done is build software that can figure out how molecules are metabolized and become reactive. That's the particular mechanism we really care about. So metabolized is how our body usually detoxifies drugs. But it turns out that sometimes the detoxification processes end up backfiring and making a drug more toxic. And so we have algorithms that can basically predict how it's going to be changed by your liver into what's usually a less toxic form, but then also we can predict when it's not actually less toxic, it's more toxic.
Wow. Yeah. Astounding number of implications there and possibilities. So one of the things we often do with guests on this podcast is talk about the link between sort of this kind of core academic research and Christian faith. And in your case, I don't know if the link's going to be any easier, but at least the output is easier to identify, because you have in 2019 through InterVarsity Press, The Genealogical Adam and Eve, The Surprising Science of Universal Ancestry. And here in this book, you're using your expertise and research as a scientist to really help Christians wrestle with and understand better a pretty complex idea at the intersection of science and theology. So we definitely want to talk about the book, but can you talk a bit about how your own kind of vocational sense of moving from the sort of lab-based research we were just talking about to the kind of work that is meant to help Christians, you know, who aren't scientists, understand complex issues important to their faith? I'd love to hear kind of some of the progression and links that you saw yourself making.
Yeah, so what I described earlier was like this hyper-focused, narrow place where I have just a lot of expertise and publications, right? That's how science works. But when you get right down to it, I'm a scientist. And I have broad interests like most scientists do, and we tend to be omnivores, and we just read a lot of different things. And that's, I think, really where, I mean, I'd say that's also particularly true of interdisciplinary scientists like me that are between multiple fields, right? And so that's part of what's going on here. In my book, I'm really engaging with a large number of fields, right? I'm engaging with philosophers, historians, theologians, population geneticists, and anthropologists to look at this, you know, grand question of what it means to be human and who we are and where we came from. But there's other things here too, which tie into my journey and my path. You know, most Christians and the scientists and the sciences really go through some common points of real struggle trying to make sense of Genesis alongside, you know, the mainstream account of evolution, right? And most churches either handle that in a very conflicted way or in an avoidant way. But if you're a student in the sciences, neither of those approaches really works well. You have really big questions that arise, and you need something better than just unending conflict. And there's just these sticky parts that's just very difficult for people to work through. It was very hard for me. And when I talked to seekers that I met in the science, people who were curious about Jesus, it was also another place where there was a lot of questions and really not a lot of clarity. And like I said, they would either see avoidance in the church or they'd see a lot of conflict. And when I looked at it, as I started to understand this more and more, I realized that not only was there conflict and avoidance, that a lot of the conflict and avoidance was really rooted in some real confusion about what really the science was actually saying. There's a lot of things that people thought were in conflict with science that really weren't when you looked at it closely. And so that's why I ended up writing this book, to really help serve, both seekers in science, other scientists that were following Jesus, and also the larger church community to understand really what it was that we were dealing with when it came to human origins in mainstream science.
Mm. Josh, I'm curious to hear what sort of questions you have found to be helpful in this journey of investigation. Because, you know, I think as a scientist, you know, a lot of what you do rides on being able to ask the right kinds of questions, regardless of whether you find an answer or not. So what kinds of questions do you think are important to ask when one is on a journey like this?
Yeah, so when you're looking at a situation like this, when we're talking about human origins, it's been a locus of conflict for a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. And a big question, I mean, and there's other places like that too. We could talk about race, questions of race. We could talk about questions of sexuality, all of these things are the places of immense conflict for a very long time, long since any of us were born, right? So then I think the key thing I really wanted to do is to really understand and to really ask questions oriented at really understanding why people thought what they thought, what was important to them and why. And in the question of origins, there's certain things that just keep on coming up. I mean, there's the debates about the age of the earth, but most people would say that's not really the core of the problem. The real core of the problem are these questions of human origins. And particularly when we look at scripture, and if we take that seriously, it seems to be telling us things about Adam and Eve. And these things end up becoming really important in theology and even tying to things that Jesus said. How do we make sense of that if evolution is true? That kept up coming up over and over and over again, that I saw both from talking to people individually, reading articles, reading books. And there was also, once again, a lot of confusion. People really across the spectrum were very certain that certain things were logically incompatible or logically in contradiction that just weren't. And to narrow it down a little more about Adam and Eve, there's the two key things that kept on coming up over and over again was the idea, it was a question really. It wasn't even my question. It was really their question or the church's question more broadly, is if Adam and Eve are real people in a real past, do we all descend from them? Mm-hmm. That was the first question. Another question that comes up, maybe not asked frequently, but if evolution is true, does that mean that Adam and Eve were not de novo created without parents? That kept up coming up over and over again. And a lot of people, when they read scripture, it just really seems like it's teaching that Adam and Eve were created out of the dust and out of a rib. And it's an issue of scriptural authority. It's an issue of obedience even and lordship for many Christians to affirm that. And most people thought that was in conflict with evolution. And it turns out, this is like the really cool thing that I found out as I looked into it closer, is that those things actually aren't in conflict. I mean, maybe you would reject evolution. But if evolution were true, it turns out that Adam and Eve could be ancestors of us all. And in fact, they could have been de novo created without parents.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really like about your work, Josh, and also your engagement with church leaders is you're giving permission to church leaders to ask some of these hard questions, mm-hmm. right? And to engage with them at a level of scientific expertise from someone like you. And I've been encouraged to see, you know, through our own Carver classroom here where you're working with pastors and ministry leaders, but also some of the growing interest from seminaries to engage with some of your work, that there are church leaders and institutions out there who really want to jump into this conversation and be able to navigate the questions, not because they're at the end of the day going to understand the science, but because they understand the value of engaging with scientific expertise and not kind of walling it off as something that's, you know, not part of what what Christians do or what theologians do. So I've been encouraged to see it. I wonder if you could reflect a bit on your own relational engagement with pastors and ministry leaders and seminary professors and how some of that's gone.
Yeah, I have to say that that's been one of the most fun things about this book, is to just see how it has been very helpful to churches that have, for a good reason, avoided the conflict issues in origins, right? So the way you deal with it is just avoid it. But then this kind of gives us a way to engage in a far more productive, creative way that works with diverse congregations, that isn't really inquisitorial. And the reason why I think I'm most excited about it is really for the science students like me that really struggle through this. But I would also say for the seekers in science, there's a lot of people who are curious about Jesus and the sciences, but there just isn't churches they can go to ask these questions. You framed it in the right way, John. I mean, I think a lot of people haven't felt like there's a place to go ask the hard questions about this and have them, you know, addressed with seriousness. And a lot of pastors felt that. They felt like they were just being told to just, you know, sit down and accept what the science said and, you know, make theology adapt. Or just oppose science, one of the two. But, you know, that's not very life-giving. That's a hard way to do it. And I really just wanted to take those questions seriously. And I think it's true also for a lot of people in our congregations, and certainly for seekers. Like, one of the main reasons why students leave the church, they found out when they surveyed them, is that they didn't feel like church was a place that they could ask their questions. And you know, I don't have all the answers, but what I do try to do is just give an honest account of what I've seen in the sciences. And I think what we find out is that there's just a broad range of view, a far broader range of views that is compatible with mainstream science than we'd really thought. And that should be exciting for us, for those of us that want to find a better way than just avoidance or conflict.
I really love what you said too about how I think we all come at faith from different perspectives, and it's okay to acknowledge that that for different people, certain questions might be more meaningful to them than others. So whether it's questions around human origin, or if it's race that to you is important, that you think about what kinds of questions you want to ask of the origins of our faith from that angle. And I love that you're sort of, you know, in your work and in your book encouraging young people and ministry leaders to engage with those questions, ask those questions, regardless of if we can necessarily agree on the answers, but at least that's one step closer to us creating an environment where we can have that discussion.
Yeah, and I think there's another surprise that I learned around this, to jump off what you said, is I found out in terms of Christian theology, I didn't know this, to be honest, before I started spending time with theologians and going deeper into this. It turns out that human origins is just a crossroad of so many core theological questions that get caught up in how we think about Adam and Eve, which is why people were saying that was such a big deal. And I didn't quite get this, because I was just like a reader of scripture in the church who's a scientist and who was not that connected to theology. And then as I looked at it more, I realized, oh, this is why everyone's complaining about Adam and Eve. And to tie it in, I didn't realize that some of the concerns that I had as a dark-skinned Indian in St. Louis with questions about race and justice, I didn't realize that those are questions that, in Christian theology at least, take us right through the crossroad of Adam and Eve. One of the things that I found out as I was doing this, and I ended up writing a whole chapter on it, is that it turns out that race, one way to understand how it arises in history that I think is a very helpful way to understand it, is that it's really a false theory of origins. And it's a false theory of origins that most of the church rejected because they affirmed that we all descend from Adam and Eve. What it was historically was, you know, when we discovered people living on the other side of Earth in America, because everyone was in the other side before, right? At least in the theological conversation among Christians, people wondered what to make sense of these people in the new world. And some people said, well, maybe God just made people across the earth, and these are people that don't descend from Adam and Eve. And that basic idea becomes the core kernel of idea that gives rise to our conceptions about race, this idea that there's different types of people across the earth today still. that have different intrinsic abilities and worth and calling and position in the world according to God. And that powerful idea ends up justifying things like colonialism, things like slavery, things like segregation. And it turns out to be just not true. We're far more connected than it first seemed, that those people over in the New World, if Adam and Eve were real, even if they were just really recent, they would still descend from Adam and Eve. They weren't a different race of people. We're all the same race. We're all one family. We're the human family.
Yeah, I'm really struck by your phrase, too, about the false theory of origins and how that plays out in many other disciplines, whether we're talking about 1789 or the beginning of human beings or whatever it is, that part of Christian responsibility is to be truth tellers in the most sophisticated way we can. And part of truth telling as Christians is necessarily going to depend on subject matter expertise, right? Because we're just not all going to be experts on everything in the world. And so how do we think through, for the sake of how we live now, accuracy in memory, accuracy in understanding, accuracy in theories, and that just takes a lot of mutual trust in expertise. And I'm struck that increasingly today, expertise itself is being questioned. We've got proliferation of pseudo experts. And so how do you think about the challenges to expertise, and how do you navigate some of those conversations when you encounter them?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's like the million-dollar question. I mean, I think you hit a lot of stuff that I just want to highlight, and also maybe tell you a little bit about the language I use to describe what I do to my colleagues, too. But I think a key part of any quality expertise is this humility to understand that our expertise is not enough, right? As an expert in what I do, I have certain abilities. I have a piece of the puzzle, but to really have an impact on this, I mean, I have to interact with other experts too, engage with things that are outside my expertise, and also engage with people who are out there in the real world outside, like the ivory tower, right? Mm-hmm. And it's more about these connections and collaborative things where expertise is part of it, but isn't everything. That's really critical. And it takes a certain type of humility to make that even possible. That's one thing I think that you do really well, John, and I hope people see that come out in my book as well. But I think another issue too that experts really struggle with, and I've had to work hard against it, and I've learned a lot about this too, and this is how I explain it to my colleagues as well. What I tell them is that, if you see the problems that are out there, the issue is not merely people don't have the right information. Like, all the right information's out there already. The bigger issue is that there isn't trust. It's not a knowledge deficit that we're dealing with. It's really a trust deficit. Mm. And what I'm trying
to... That's interesting. I would say trust and discernment, right? Because we almost have the opposite of a knowledge gap. We've got too much information. So part of it, it's trust and discerning the right kinds of information.
Wouldn't you say? Yeah, that's the one we put. They're trusting the wrong places. And so when we think about, places where... we can see with our own two eyes that that's just not true. Well, what's going on there? The problem is not that they don't know that other people think differently. The problem is that they're trusting the wrong. They're not trusting people who actually do. They're not trusting the right information, is the other way to put it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think quality public engagement, that's how I'd explain what I do to my colleagues, is I tell them that, I'm a scientist. I do my scientific work, but I also am doing, I really care about engaging the public on scientific things. But to do that well, it's not actually about having all the right answers alone. I mean, having some right answers is certainly helpful, but ultimately we have to be starting to ask questions about how we build trust with people that are very distrustful of us. And that is really where the core of public engagement work needs to focus, is how we build trust in places that are unlikely, that are outside the beaten path, and where people might even really hate us. How do we build trust there?
Yeah, I love what you said about quality public engagement. And I think too, it's not uncommon that when it comes to the perceptions that people have of whether it's experts or scientists is that they're not able to necessarily relate or translate what they do in layman terms. And it sounds like over time in your journey you have continue to work at finding those inroads to meet people where they are and to work through how to ask certain questions in different ways to arrive at potential solutions or a consensus. And I don't know, I think it's all really interesting, but I wonder if it would just be helpful to, I'm now more than ever curious to just learn a little bit more about just your journey, how you arrived to where you are today, and maybe just share with our listeners a little bit about how you found your way into studying the sciences and even beyond that, your clinical experience and just, you know, just share that journey a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so my mom was a missionary doctor and now she runs a crisis pregnancy center in Orange County, California. Really making pennies on the dollar what she would if she was working as an OB-GYN like she's trained to do. But that had a huge impact. I mean, I wanted to be a physician and to really serve, really serve in places like my mom did, honestly. I really just had a great respect for that. I got into pre-med and found out that though I could, I was swinging the classes just fine in pre-med, that I wasn't really as attracted to like the day-to-day of what it meant to be a physician. And, you know, I was kind of pursuing that still. And, you know, one of the things you have to do for getting into medical school is to take, you know, research classes, hands-on working in a lab. And I think in that context, I just really fell in love with doing science. And, you know, one of the things that I really silenced during this period too was, you know, this attraction I had for math and programming. But, you know, the year I graduated from undergrad was 2000. That's when the human genome was sequenced. And more people were starting to realize the importance of like really bringing more mathematical and computational approach to study problems of biology for the purpose of public health. And so there's a new field that was popping up called bioinformatics. And it was very providential how it all worked out. But I ended up getting finding out. I didn't even know about this stuff was possible until like literally like months before the application deadlines and things like that. But I ended up getting into a combined degree program where I did my medical degree for 2 years, then my PhD for 5 years, then 2 years for my medical degree. It was all on a scholarship, so that was great. But I spent my entire 20s in graduate school, and I knew that I wanted to be a professor down the line, and I wasn't really sure about clinical medicine all the time. But after a lot of thinking about it, I ended up deciding to apply for a residency, and I got I was pretty well received on the residency path. But one of the last places I visited was WashU, and WashU, something really amazing happened. That morning, I kind of gave a talk on my research, and then there was kind of some bustling, and you know, I kind of asked questions, and people asked me kind of what I wanted to do in the long run, and there was some bustling in the back of the room, and then I got this new schedule. They basically had me meet with the director of the program and the chair of the department, and they said, you know, we brought you in here as a to interview for residency, but honestly, we want to consider. We want to include you as a faculty member. We want to hire you as a faculty member. And so would you mind letting us interview you for that? What do you think about that? So that was the craziest. If you're curious, that is not normal. Wow. I've never heard
of that. Yeah.
And so long story short, I ended up taking the faculty position and starting the department. That was about 10 years ago. And so I skipped doing residency. I skipped doing a postdoc. I skipped even applying for faculty in a normal way, but I started here at WashU as a professor, and it was really providential because it gave me a jump start on my research career. It put me in a place where I could actually enter into the public sphere a lot quicker than if it had been the other paths.
Listening to that, what I love about the early part of that story was kind of the presence or the discernment to realize really early on that the applied clinical med doctor side of things wasn't your natural passion. And to, you know, I think about how many students I encounter in my undergraduate classes who, you know, parents or others have put them on this pre-med track and you kind of almost get blinders. Like, I've got to do this. And the opportunity to open up the possibilities that maybe you're called to something else. And it's often a two-way street. It's faculty mentors, but it's also a student awareness and self-awareness to be able to say, oh yeah, I'm actually, maybe I'm wired differently from what I thought. And so it was really, really powerful to hear that part of your.
Yeah, John. And if I could just interject here a little bit, the fact that it wasn't just, you know, them, your mentors or people, you know, in positions of influence, seeing that in you, but it's them creating a pathway for you to go in and pursue research and teaching. If you decided to do that, that is astounding to me. That's amazing.
Yeah, there was a lot of mentors involved in it. It was a process, but yeah, I think I really was fortunate. I definitely think that students and parents in particular, I mean, the way how vocation and career works out is it just really does take a lot of mentorship for some people. You know, we're just difficult. I was a problem case, I think. I remember one point in the journey too. It did take courage. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, you know, I'm Indian, right? When I wanted to be a doctor, my family was very excited and proud about it. And I remember at a certain point thinking, oh my goodness, I have to tell my dad that I'm not sure if I want to be a physician. And that was a terrifying thought. And what was interesting, I remember pulling him aside to tell him this, and we talked, and I was terrified, honestly, because he's a strong-willed guy, right? And, you know, by God's grace, what he did is what I hope that we would all do for our kids. It's not that he didn't care about what I did. He said, you know, he'd been really praying about it too, and he's starting to wonder the same thing.
Wow.
And he said, you know, maybe you should still keep on doing the pre-med stuff, but really start exploring what the other thing could be. And that's what I ended up doing. And I'm really glad I didn't leave pre-med because it ended up being important for getting into an MD-PhD, right? But there was like a sensitivity where, yeah, of course, you know, he's of the culture and all that. And for good reasons and bad reasons, I'm sure he wanted me to be a physician. But as my father, he also had a sensitivity to really want me more than anything else to serve the Lord in what I did. And he was going to give me the freedom to do that.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's awesome.
Awesome.
We are, we're already quickly approaching the end of time as we always do on this. It just flies by. I wonder though, maybe for the last question to give you the last word, Josh, can you tell us maybe something that's exciting you at the moment or an opportunity you see in the next few years, as a Christian, as a scholar and researcher, as someone talking to public audiences, what do you see as really exciting and hopeful in the time ahead?
I'm really hopeful about the conversations on race. Like I said, we've been, a lot of us here in St. Louis, you guys included, we've been really thinking for a while now about race, right? And we're seeing kind of the ugly conflict spill out into the public sphere in ways that is discouraging. But I also am hopeful. I really do think that when I think about it from my narrow point of view, is I really think that there's some history here that's helpful, history in science and history in theology that can really help us work through this and work past some of the conflict to better understanding. I think there's a better way, and we're probably going to have to tussle it out a bit on some of these more negative approaches as we kind of find our way to that better way. And, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm working with the Baptist convention a little bit. I'm going to be this next year a scientist in residence at one of their seminaries, and at Peaceful Science, we're starting to look more closely at the questions of science and race as well, where maybe we can get a better handle on this idea, where it came from, what works about it, what doesn't, and to think through better how we can really understand this grand question of what it means to be human, how God made us, and how we can live as a one family together once again.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, Adam and Eve wasn't controversial enough, so you thought you'd jump into something to give you a challenge, I guess.
Well, it's funny. You know, when I was engaging the questions about origins, it started actually long before I wrote my book, and I really felt called to do it at a path to seek peace. That's why it ended up being called Peaceful Science. If you ever check that out, peacefulscience.org. And one thing that happened is I was talking to young Earth creationists and old Earth creationists, people who totally disagreed with me about evolution. Quite often, and this is before it hit the fan publicly, a lot of them says, you know, honestly, the stuff about origins is really not that difficult compared to X, Y, Z. And one of those variables would always be race. And we said, yeah, maybe in some ways what's happening is we're just getting practice on how to navigate super conflicted areas so we can start approaching these other ones. And so I think that might have been prophetic. I think honestly, when I look about the conflicts that the first has with evolution, especially, you know, with some of the stuff that I put in my book, and it's coming out in Wayne Craig's new book too, on the topic too, I think a lot of those conflicts are going to start to move pretty quickly into the rearview mirror. They're just not as important as people thought, because there's a lot of stuff that wasn't in contradiction that people thought. But then these questions of race are deeply connected to that. And
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that, well, in a lot of ways, I feel like it's funny, you know, I didn't know anything about theology before I really started this. I mean, I got a crash course in theological anthropology and the history of race. And one of my colleagues noted that there's that history is critically important in questions of science. That's why we even care about evolution, right? It's also really important in topics of theology, which is why people even care about Adam and Eve, right? Mm-hmm. But history is also really important in questions of justice.
Yes.
And to really pursue justice, you can't do that disconnected from history. And so I think that's actually where we just have to understand, if we want to engage these topics of race, we can't do it with a sort of amnesia about how we got here and what's going on. We have to do it in a way that's deeply connected with the truthful telling of the history.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Yeah, that's a great place to end. Very awesome. Thanks, Josh. This has been fantastic to dialogue a bit. And Penina, thanks as always for jumping in. And we will look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, thank you, Josh.